You're listening to the Love Yegg Show. If our city could talk, these are the stories it would tell about the people, places, and passion in Edmonton. We interview difference makers in our community. Please welcome your hosts, Sherry Beauchamp and Jesse McCracken.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Love Yegg. I'm here with my beautiful co-host, Jesse McCracken.
Hello, hello.
And today we have the privilege of being at the Sexual Assault Center in Edmonton with our friend Mary Jane James.
Hello, everyone. Nice to be here. Thank you for this privilege of being with you today.
And this is obviously our first time walking in. We actually met you. You were nominated by one of our members, mm-hmm. and you came and presented to us. I think that was over a year. It was last year.
Last year, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and that actually was one of the most memorable events mm-hmm. for me personally, because you did something I thought was super courageous at the time. You got up there. We voted, and SACE got the majority votes. And you went up to the front and you said, "Can I say something?" I said, "Sure." So you grabbed the mic and you said, "Here's what I'd like to do." And mm-hmm. you said, "I would like to share the donations with the other charities that are here." So that was like the first time mm-hmm. that had really happened. And I thought that was so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, just something tugged at my heart. I mean, obviously, we need the money and appreciate the money just as much or more than any other charitable, not-for-profit, trying to do great things in this city for all of us. But I just really felt in that particular moment that the two charities that were with me that night were, you know, equally as in need and equally as amazing and doing equally as great work. And I just thought, I know the voting system, you know, the folks who were there could only choose one. And luckily for us, it was SACE. But so that was a real defining moment for me, too, because I thought, you know, really, at the end of the day, we're all in this together, mm-hmm. and they're doing what they do, and they're doing it really well, and we're trying to do what we do, and we hope we're doing it well. And so let's just work together and be, you know, together in a mission to make this a greater and better city for all of us. And so that's what happened.
I love that. I love that so much. Yeah. I remember you saying that we're all in this together, and that just, like, totally stuck with me.
It's true, you know. You can talk the talk, but it's you know, elevate that to walk the walk. And that is what makes our city so great, because I think there's a lot of those people living mm-hmm. amongst us who are very, very unselfish, very giving of their time, very generous. You know, you see that over and over again mm-hmm. When there's, you know, struggles, either individual crises or fundraisers or bigger annual fundraisers like Santa's Anonymous, etc. We always seem to rise to the occasion. Mm-hmm. And it just gives you a really good feeling about living here. It's one of the things that I love about being an Edmontonian, for sure.
I'm a really big sports fan, and, you know, the City of Champions, that sort of was crowned after, you know, the glory days here in Edmonton when, you know, both the Eskimos and the Oilers were on top. But to me, that's what the City of Champions is. It's just like this mentality that Edmontonians have about, you know, our city and what they're willing to do for it and the distance they're willing to go together, I think is something really cool.
You're absolutely right. And I never really thought of it like that, you know, parlaying the City of Champions related to sports to who we are as individuals. Mm-hmm. But that's very true. Do you remember when they were going to change that slogan?
Totally.
And I thought, I don't know about that. I mean, I like it. But anyway, yeah, that's a really good point.
So, like, I had never been to SACE before. This mm-hmm. is my first time here. We get the privilege walking through those doors. Mm-hmm. It's like a really, it feels really comfortable and welcoming and
calm.
Yeah,
it
totally.
Was very, like, walked in and it just was like, first thing I said to her, it was like, this is a beautiful space. Yeah.
Super professional, super, you know, like, I think it's a really, do you want to tell us a bit about what you guys do here and sort of the vision behind all of that?
Absolutely. So thank you for that compliment about our space. We have been in this building, which is more like in the industrial area of Edmonton, yeah, because it's more affordable and because there's lots of street parking and free parking. For many of our clients, that would be a barrier to have to pay for that. So all of those things thrown in, we started leasing space here in 2001. And here we are 19 years later. Interestingly, we started off with about a third of the space we have now. Then we sort of grew into, you know, a few more square feet. And about a year and a half ago, we took over the whole floor. So we actually occupy 10,000 square feet. So when we were sharing the space with other tenants, you know, the space was obviously cut up with all kinds of different paint and different finishing and different flooring. Mm-hmm. And I just had this vision. I thought, you know what, if we're going to do this, we're going to do it right. I want this space to be warm, safe, inviting, not opulent by any stretch, but very, very comfortable so that, you know, if you're accessing services that are no fee, for free,
right,
with a not-for-profit, there is this common misperception that those services wouldn't be necessarily as good or as helpful as those that you'd pay $180 an hour for, right, which is completely untrue. We have the best trauma therapists in the city, in my opinion. They've trained for years and years and years about trauma related to sexual violence. So at the time when we when I started here in 2007, mm-hmm, I had just finished staying at home with my children for 15 years. I came out of the corporate world. I had no intention of staying home with my kids. And my little son, who was born in 1992, sort of changed all that for me, gave my life a different perspective, slowed me down a bit. And mm-hmm, then we had two more children in the next 2.5 years. So it was like, wow, okay, that was fast.
and then we were five.
Yeah, exactly. And I sort of immersed myself at that time in my community and volunteer work and sat on some boards and did some fundraising for whoever and whatever. And in 2007, something spoke to me. I had a situation in my life where someone I know who was impacted by sexual violence, it was gut-wrenching, to say the least, to walk through that with her. And I thought, wow, you know, sexual violence, that I really don't understand much about that, only what I learned through my journey with this friend, daughter of a friend, actually. So I started looking up sexual assault. Where do people go for help in this city? What do they do when that happens? Mm-hmm. And obviously this popped up on the computer and I did some investigating and I found out that they had a 24-hour crisis line. I thought, I should see if I could volunteer on that. So did the interview, you know, mm-hmm, had to be like, go through all these hoops and checks, and which understandably, of course, and they accepted me. Oh, wow, that was great. And I went through 60 hours of training to be a crisis line volunteer. Mm-hmm. And I started working on the crisis line, which was good for me at that time. So my kids were still relatively young and I could do it from home. And it was a 24-hour line and you take shifts, you sign up for them. And the first call I got was just mind-blowing. He was a young man. He identified himself as 17. He identified himself as being sexually abused by his stepfather for years and years and years. He moved out of the house, moved out of the abuse, was living on the streets, was going to go into the sex trade to be able to survive. And I remember they told me in training, spend about 20 minutes and then you should, you know, wind it down because you're, you know, you've got to leave. I was on the phone with him for about 3 hours. I almost wanted to, you know, invite him to my home and adopt him. And, you know, I think of him almost every single day of my life. I think of this young man. Where is he now? Did he make it? Is he safe? Is he still vulnerable? And it really tugs at me a lot at a very deep level. So I continued on with that crisis line for about a year. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a great balance for me to be feeling I could do something and still be at home with my kids and my husband. And then in the next year in 2008, they asked me to come into the office and do a little bit of volunteering. And I did that very part-time. And then, I don't know, it just one thing just morphed into the next. And all of a sudden in 2012, I'm approached by the board to be the assistant executive director. And then in 2015, I took over as CEO when my predecessor retired. So, you know, it was an evolution and a journey that I never imagined. It was not in my on my radar at all, but is one that has absolutely changed my life in more ways than I can possibly describe. Mm-hmm. I have a passion for this issue that I never imagined possible. I get up every day with the knowledge that I have a privilege to be working with people who have experienced unspeakable, indescribable trauma due to no fault of their own. And I recognize the privilege that I have, not only with my privilege in society as a white, you know, educated professional woman, but as someone who has not had to experience that on a deep level like so many people do. And when you think of the statistics of sexual violence, 1 in 3 girls, women, 1 in 6 boys will experience sexual violence at some point in their lifetime. And, you know, just think about those numbers. And when I speak in public, I always say, you know, we all know someone who has been impacted, whether we realize we do or not.
Totally.
Because so few people speak up about their experience due to so many things, not the least of which is the victim blaming, the assumptions that you must have played a part in whatever you did that happened to you. Why did you drink so much? Why did you dress like that? Why did you walk to your car alone? So as a society, we have historically always wanted to find a way to excuse the behavior of the perpetrator and place the blame on the victim, which is crazy.
Yeah.
If you parlay that into a comparison with anything else, you wouldn't blame a downhill skier for getting a catastrophic head injury because they were a skier. You wouldn't blame them, but we do that. And we at SACE are trying, we work tirelessly every day to break that rape culture into pieces and say, the only person to blame for this is the person who chose to commit the act of violence against someone else. So, as I say, this wasn't on my radar. I was very ensconced in the corporate world. I loved what I did. I had a great job. And now I can't imagine doing anything else. And as I enter into my, what would that be, my 12th year of being associated with SACE, I
think,
where did that time go? But looking back, we have grown so much. I don't know if you knew this or not, but in 1975, Edmonton was dubbed the rape capital of Canada.
That is not the city of champions.
No doubt.
Right? We wouldn't want that on a billboard, would we? But at that time, a bunch of concerned citizens, after it was made public, and it was sort of international news. It was like, wow, Edmonton, Alberta, where's that? They have more rapes per capita than any other city in their country. So a group of concerned citizens sort of banded together and through, whatever means they had, they started a crisis line. And that's how the Sexual Assault Center of Edmonton started, with a group of volunteers. Then it just morphed a little bit into hiring a part-time person. And here we are today with 45 staff. We have 80 volunteers who work on two crisis lines that we have now. One is our own line, and one is a provincial line that we work in conjunction with the Calgary Sexual Assault Center in facilitating and responding to, and that's also a text and a chat line. So our volunteers are largely responsible for that, and we support them in backing them up and in on their shifts, etc. So it's really a collaborative effort.
So at what point did you realize that you guys needed to grow and service more people? Because you said you've grown into a bigger space. Is it always the need was there, and you, or has it gotten progressively worse over time?
Well, that's a great question. I think that you know what I think was the pivotal point? I mean, we've always, demand has always exceeded capacity here, always. But when the Me Too movement took place, that was a watershed moment for this issue.
Give
that
more people
was
a voice.
When people started, you know, recognizing, hey, you know, I'm not the only person this happened to. Mm-hmm. And maybe there is someone out there who could support me and provide me with the resources that I need to move forward. And during that time, our provincial association, which is the Alberta Association of Sexual Assault Services, we launched a campaign called I Believe You, mm-hmm. We Believe You. And it was billboard, TV, radio, and it was sort of...
It's right on the wall when you walk in.
I took a picture when I walked in. I was like, that's beautiful.
We want every survivor out there to know that when you contact SACE or any sexual assault center across the province, you are going to meet with a person who is compassionate, who is caring, who will meet you with no judgment attached, and you can feel safe to start your journey, whatever that journey looks like for you. Mm-hmm. And for some, it means getting counseling. For some, it means reporting to the police. For some, it means going to the media. And we just strongly believe that a person is the pilot of their own journey, and we are just there to support that person in whatever direction they want to go. And of course, if counseling is something that they want to pursue, then we have an amazing team of psychologists registered and provisionally registered psychologists and social workers who will be there with them every step of the way. Mm-hmm. There is no sort of minimum or maximum number of sessions. We're not going to cut you off at, you know, 3 to say, okay, see you, thanks very much for coming. We're there with you till you feel ready to move on.
Wow.
And it really is, you know, I think of this, and when I speak to funders, and our largest funder, of course, is the government of Alberta, and they've been very, very supportive, and I'm trusting that they will continue to be. You know, we can, as a society, pay it now or pay it later, but the effects and manifestations of childhood sexual abuse are undoubtedly one of the biggest barriers to that person being able to go on to lead a healthy, productive life.
Yeah.
Homelessness, you know, lack of education, lack of stable housing, poverty, you name it.
Self-confidence,
self-confidence. You know, trauma embeds the soul at a level that is really difficult to comprehend until you've experienced it yourself. Mm-hmm. And so I just say to all of your listeners, all of our listeners out there, do yourselves a favor and promise yourself one thing, that if someone comes to you and discloses to you that something's happened to them, just be there. Mm-hmm. Just listen, be supportive, and say 3 words, which are surprisingly simple, and that's, I believe you.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
You know, people say to me all the time, what can I do? How can I help? This is how you can help. Mm-hmm. The second other way you could help is to understand how bystanders contribute to the perpetuation of this crime. Mm-hmm. You know, listening to, you know, ha-ha rape jokes about women, unflattering statements, etc. Just, you know, accepting that that's got to be part of our society is really a low common denominator. I think we're better than that.
Yeah, and I really do think that the Me Too movement, just because it was so worldwide, really has changed maybe the culture in some of the locker rooms and changed culture just in general. So hopefully this next generation of boys and girls, you know, they are just a little bit more aware or a little bit more confident to say that's not okay, you know? And I think that before people would just kind of go along with it, whereas now there is people standing up a little bit more for themselves or for others when they hear things that are maybe inappropriate, whereas that wasn't what they did because it was just, they would laugh along with it. Maybe uncomfortable laugh, but they would still just laugh along with it because they didn't know how to say that's not okay.
And you know, I want to say that SAIS is a safe haven for victims of sexual violence of all genders. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously it happens disproportionately yeah. to women and girls, but we provide services and support to all genders, all sexualities, all ethnicities, mm-hmm. all backgrounds. We are there for everyone. Mm-hmm. And that's an important consideration, because I don't ever want anyone to think it's very, very difficult as a woman or a girl to come forward mm-hmm. with a disclosure of sexual violence. But put that into perspective, if you're a member of the LGBTQ mm-hmm. population, or a man, or you know, whatever the case may be, mm-hmm. a different culture, a different ethnicity, there's a whole host of other layers yeah. that are put in front of you. So we just want everyone to know that we're here for everyone, and we will meet you where you're at mm-hmm. and we will walk alongside you in your journey, whatever that may be.
Wow. So what kind of support do you guys provide, like say families of a member of their family that was, you know, affected, or is there ongoing services for the families as well to know how to support them, or do you, you know, kind of encourage them to go to some other places?
Again, you know, it's we're meeting the client where they're at. So certainly we provide services for individuals ages 3 and up. So we have tons of 3-year-olds. We have a playroom Man. That's utilized yeah. every minute of every day for therapeutic play and art. And our oldest client was 87. Mm. Break your heart, absolutely. But for the children and the mm-hmm. youth, if there's a parent, a non-offending parent or caregiver who wants to be part of that healing process with that person, absolutely, we're all in. Whatever it takes. We also provide group counseling for supporters of sexual violence. So if you're a parent, a mm-hmm. friend, a spouse, mm-hmm. a caregiver of someone who's experienced that, we have a group once a month that just people come and they share their difficulties, their issues, their thoughts, and we provide some resources, perhaps some grounding techniques or some, you know, referrals to other community resources where mm-hmm. they may find they would get some help for their own trauma, because it's not just the person in the family who's been traumatized. Mm-hmm. Other family members are impacted as well. So mm-hmm. we have to recognize that to heal one person, we have to heal the family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so within the ability of our capacity to do so, we're there for all of the people in the lives of that survivor.
Wow.
So we provide individual counseling. Mm-hmm. Usually we say about 15 sessions per person, but it can go as high as 60 sessions.
Right.
And for some, maybe they don't need as many, it may be less. But we provide group counseling. We have 7 groups running all the time, men's group, teens group, supporters of victims group, historical sexual violence for women, recent sexual violence for women. So we just try to just figure out what is it the community needs, mm-hmm. how can we respond, what can we do. We also have groups that are specifically for the LGBTQ2S+ community, because they are impacted by sexual violence at twice the rate of anyone else. We actually have another group for just Indigenous women who've been impacted by sexual violence, because they too are impacted by sexual violence at an alarming rate. Mm-hmm. So we do a lot of environmental scans to figure out where are the needs, mm-hmm. what can we do, how can we play a part. Because this is a healing of our community.
Yeah.
The mm-hmm. healing of the individual and the family, but the healing of our community. So yeah, we that's what we do.
Wow.
So we kind of talked about this a little bit before. So some of this type of behavior can be cyclical or generational, or mm-hmm. what's sort of been your experience with that?
Well, you know, that's just such a tough question.
Totally.
It's such a tough question, because we don't know in our little worlds what goes on in the lives of other families and individuals.
Right.
And we don't know what the history has been. Certainly within the Indigenous population, there is a history. The residential school system was a fire dumpster for children being pulled away from their parents and then not realizing what healthy relationships were. They're pulled away from mm-hmm. everything they knew. and put into an environment where they were abused, neglected, physically abused, sexually abused, neglected. And then they shut down, you know, the residential schools were shut down, and they went back and flung back into their the environment that they were pulled from in the first place and expected to be, you know, just forget about it, move on, and be, you know, healthy and productive. And, you know, it just doesn't happen. And so there's generational colonization and marginalization that goes on within that community, but they're not the only ones. I think there's just a lot of unhealthy families, and you have to, as I said earlier, you have to heal the family before you can heal the child. And you have to, you know, I think within the sexual violence epidemic that we have between the for the young adults between the ages of 18 and 24, that is a very significant problem. And not all those individuals who are committing those acts of violence have come from unhealthy backgrounds. They are a product of this, it's just sex sort of mentality. I wasn't violent. She was drunk, and or he was drunk, and, you know, we had sex, but it wasn't sexual violence, but yes, it was, because we have to understand what consent is.
Yeah.
And that is part of, we have a very, very, very busy public education team. There's like 12 people on there, on that team alone, who are out in the public every day educating our students and our adults about what consent is and what it's not, what healthy boundaries are and what they're not. What you know, what it looks like if you are going to engage in sexual activities with a person who is unable to give consent because they are either under the influence of drugs or alcohol or both. So, you know, these are the stepping stones. This prevention piece is where we are really trying to amp up our efforts. We'll always be here for the intervention piece, the counseling.
Yeah.
But we've tripled our public education team because we know the need is out there. We're training first responders. We're training teachers. We're training lawyers. We're training, you know, we're just out there. And because in addition to what we know is sexual violence being the really awful extreme acts, rape, et cetera, there's also a ton of sexual harassment that goes on in the workplace that women in particular have just accepted it as their, you know, lot in life, if you will, to have men gaping at them and touching them inappropriately. And it's only since the Harvey Weinstein, you know, revelations that women are like, yeah, you know what? That happened to me. My boss said that to me. My coworker did that to me. So we've had a real rise in demand for professional organizations to come in and talk to them about, to talk to their staff about sexual harassment, and that actually is a crime punishable under the law. So, you know, we've come a long, long, long way. We have a long way to go. Sexual violence is still happening at the same rate or more that it was in the past. But what we want is to be able to keep talking about that. That's going to affect change. And to encourage those who have been impacted to reach out. It doesn't have to be to SACE. It doesn't have to be to any professional organization. It doesn't have to be to the police. But reach out to someone that they trust and start, you know, addressing that trauma and what they've buried deep down in their heart and their soul for a very long time. Because ultimately, you deserve that, to give that gift to yourself.
Right? So what is the process? So if someone is in a situation where they would like to seek help or your services, or what about the reverse, where maybe you suspect something's going on in a relationship, or, you know, what should people do, or what would you recommend how to approach that conversation? Or do you have any tools or things like that that would be appropriate for that?
Well, certainly with children, as adults, we have a responsibility if we even suspect, and it can be for the most innocuous of reasons, that a child is being abused. it is our legal and moral obligation to report that to the police or children's services. So that's kind of a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people, they, I don't want to get involved. What if it's not true? I don't want to ruin that family life. Flip that around and think about, you don't want to ruin the life of that family, but what's happening to that child right now? Mm-hmm. You know, all of those cases we hear in the news after, and, you know, somebody should have said something, but nobody did, mm-hmm. because we all were like, not sure about that. So I encourage you not to make false allegations or to make trouble or to you know, just be that fly in the ointment, if you will. But if you have reason to suspect there's something going on in that home, and there's lots of indicators, lots, then do something. Mm-hmm. Speak up. For adults, I mean, that's a little bit of a trickier thing to
for
navigate.
Sure.
I mean, obviously, it's a very personal thing. It is why there's a very low conviction rate and a very low reporting rate, because typically it's an experience that happens between two people. There were no witnesses, so it's sort of a one person's word against the other person's mm-hmm. word, and that's very difficult for us even to get our heads around. And we do this every day, you know. But what I would say, if you know, I don't think it's probably within our place, unless it's a personal friend or relative that you think, you know, just ask those broad, open-ended questions. Are you okay? You know, is there anything happening? Is mm-hmm. there, you know, do you want to go have a glass of wine? That's my fix for most things. Maybe they'll open up. And if they do, open that door wide for them mm-hmm. to allow them to tell you in confidence whatever they feel comfortable telling you. And insofar as the process for accessing services at SACE, it's very simple. Pick up the phone. And you'll be put through to a social worker who will do an intake process with you at whatever level you want.
That's the hotline you're talking about, right?
No,
The
hotline will refer you to our intake departments, our mm-hmm. client care advocates.
Yep, got it.
We have three of them. Mm-hmm. And they will do an intake with you over the phone mm-hmm. or in person, your choice. They will match you up with the therapist who they think would be a good fit for you, or you may have some, or that person may have some ideas of the type of person that they want. Some women do not want a man, for instance, as a therapist.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Some men will only go to men. So we have to make sure that we have a broad range of options for folks. And then this is the tricky piece. We have a wait list in our adult program. Right now it's about 6 months.
Wow.
And in our adolescent program, it's 4 to 6 weeks, which is better. But let me qualify that by saying that within that 6 month period of waiting, or however long it is, we'll always be there for crisis intervention. So if you need to come in and have a one-off conversation with a therapist to just get some techniques, some normalization, some grounding, then we do that. But in terms of the long-term trauma therapy, which, as mm-hmm. I said, is typically about 15 to 20 sessions, that's a 5 to 6 month wait. So that's really, really, really disheartening for someone mm-hmm. who makes that call mm-hmm. and goes through that, because that in itself
the
takes
courage.
A ton of courage.
Big, yeah.
And then to be told this. So I guess what I will say is we need, and we are engaged in, every aspect of fundraising that we can do to augment our core funding that comes from the provincial government, the City of Edmonton, and United Way, to be able to continue to provide the services that we do. We could use 2 or 3 more therapists. Is that going to happen? Probably not. We just don't have the money. But we will move mountains to make sure that that person gets the help that they need. We will not leave them hanging. We will check in with them, just make sure that they're okay. Mm-hmm. We'll do whatever we can. And that's, I guess, all we can do. If I say we're doing every single thing we can, then that's all I can do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
As a community, how can we give back, either as a volunteer or financially? So what are the options for Edmontonians to participate and help SACE be more successful than they already are?
Well, I'll tell you, we are just so grateful for the community support. Every tiny little fundraiser helps. Some people will have a yoga class and donate the proceeds to SACE. They'll have a bake sale. We've had cookie sales. Mm-hmm. We've had, and those are small little, you think, you know, incidental, 150, 200 there, but believe me, every cent counts. What we could really, really use now, I'll tell you, is in our child and adolescent program. When a child comes in, we have an area where we have stuffed animals, and they are able to pick out their stuffed animal, and that stuffed animal sort of stays with them through their counseling process. And when they graduate from counseling, we give them a blanket. And we used to have a group of women who were quilting those blankets for us, but they've since retired, and we've never been able to find anyone who could fill that void. And now we're really low on both. They have to be new stuffies. Obviously, you would want your child to have a new stuffy.
Yeah, of course.
So those are simple things, you know, buy a stuffy, drop it off. Bring in a blanket from IKEA or wherever and drop it off. Some of the individuals who access counseling here, I would venture to say a majority of them are already living in quite marginalized situations in that, you know, when other things are going on in the world, especially the economy, it impacts them at probably a higher degree of stress level than maybe the three of us could respond to. So we operate, our staff operates a food bank. So we ourselves bring in the food for this food bank, which is accessed daily by our clients. So, you know, dropping off food. Those are little simple things.
Yeah.
Obviously, the bigger thing that we would encourage everyone out there to do is to be part of the conversation in stopping this from happening, because it is such an unnecessary crime. It doesn't have to happen. It's one of the simplest things to eradicate in our world is sexual violence, because it's an intentional act of harm against another person. Just don't do it. And so be part of that conversation. Be part of the population that stands up for and says, I believe survivors. And that's not to say, before your phones are ringing off the walls, that I don't believe in due justice. I do believe in due justice. I believe that everyone is entitled to a fair and equitable hearing about what they're accused of doing. I do believe in that. But what I'm saying is, if in my experience over 12 years and in the 47 years that this agency has been in existence, the number of false accusations does not even measure on the chart. It's just not. Think about that. Why would you put yourself through that and go to court and have lawyers rip you to shreds about what you were doing and what you were wearing and how many people you've had sexual relations with in the past? Why would you do that? Think about that. And so I think we just need to change the conversation. And particularly as women, we need to stand together and be supportive of each other and recognize that we are the future. You know, Tarana Burke with the Me Too movement, they started it. And that was the rallying cry for us to stop, you know, minimizing and trivializing and normalizing and marginalizing this issue. We lived in a rape culture. We still do. Where these sorts of things we are just asked to accept. They're part of the game. No, they're not. We don't have to, and we won't. And so I, for one, and I'm not a person to be very controversial in a social setting. I prefer not to be involved with conflict. I can chew your head off in this room. But in my personal life, I'm actually quite calm and kind. But if I'm in a situation where there's something inappropriate being done or said, watch out.
Mm-hmm.
As I'm done with excusing your behavior.
Yeah.
It's just not okay. And I have a daughter. She's 25. And I want her to live in a world and to raise her children where this isn't an issue for them.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be an issue. It doesn't have to be an issue. And there's some very sick people in the world, some very, very sick people, people who choose to, you know, violate young children in unspeakable ways and then put it on the internet for all to see. You know who's as guilty as the person who made that video? The person who's watching it.
Yeah.
So, as I say, we've come a long way. But we have a long way to go, and we will not stop. I could be sitting here in my wheelchair in 20 years if you come back to visit me, still, you know, speaking from the pulpit, if you will, about the change that's needed. And and this opportunity to speak to you today, you're doing something. I say we can all do something. Well, you are. Right now, right here today, you're doing something, and I hope that everyone who's listening to this understands that they too can play a part in this issue and in making our world a safer and healthier and happy place for all of us. It doesn't have to be big. It's baby steps, and the more baby steps we take, the more we learn to walk at full stride. So That's how I feel.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It's a lot. So just what's your self-care like? Because this is a very, I can imagine, you know, what you hear every day and everybody's situations. And of course, I'm sure that there's a lot of, you feel very lucky for the life that you live when you hear how some of these other people are dealing with things. But what do you do to take care of yourself after like a rough day or rough week, rough month?
Self-care is not something I'm really, really good at. I promote it for my staff, and I encourage it, and we have self-care, you know, activities. But my go-to is yoga. And I don't mean going to yoga class, but every single day before I get dressed and get into this office, and I work a lot, I go through my practice of yoga, all the while giving thanks for whatever afforded me the privilege to be able to do what I do, to be able to make it. I want to be remembered as someone who gave a damn, as someone who recognized that with privilege comes responsibility. And, you know, in terms of the self-care that I, you know, allow myself to indulge in, I do love wine. I do love friends. I love our city and the expanse of our River Valley trails. I love to walk them. I love to, you know, go to the markets. I love the concerts and all of the things.
Maybe a round of golf or two.
I love to play a round of golf, frustratingly so, because I'd like to be and think I should be a lot better than I am, but I'm not.
Yeah.
But I've sort of recognized that I may never get there. But I love just being out there.
Yeah.
And I've sort of learned to teach myself that golf, although you are doing something, hitting a ball, it's actually a walk in the wilderness.
Therapeutic. Yeah,
you
know, totally.
So what the heck? So you took a quadruple bogey on that hole. Really doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It doesn't. And just really for me, not to be corny, but just focusing on the small things, because when I come into this office and I see and hear the stories every single day of what other people have had to endure in their lives, that's compounded by many other things that are happening, either because of what happened to them or because they were in that situation and then it happened to them. Mm-hmm. And those are two very important things to recognize, is that people who are living in marginalized, vulnerable situations, whether that's poverty, whether that's a disability, whether that's, you know, being a newcomer to a new country, they're more at risk for being sexually violated. And the converse is true too, is when you've been sexually violated and you're dealing with unhealed trauma, you often you know, find yourself in more vulnerable situations, mm-hmm. because you're coping and you're healthy.
Right.
Your health is at risk. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of both of those. So when I come in here, I try to recognize and know and be grateful for what the privilege. And I do call it a privilege. Mm-hmm. And we call it a privilege at SAIS. Not just call it, we live it. Mm-hmm. A privilege to support those who've been impacted by this. And I'll say it, it's a crime. There's no act. It's a crime. That's what it is. And so, you know, I'll try to get better at self-care. Mm-hmm. But I have a beautiful, wonderful, supportive family. I'm not an Edmontonian, you know. I moved here from Prince Edward Island in the late 80s, sort of as a stopgap to finding myself.
Landed in Edmonton.
Here I am, you know, however many years later it is. And I call it home. Mm-hmm. We're very, very lucky. We live in a beautiful, beautiful city in a very, very rich world, country, mm-hmm. that we would take that for granted and not play a part in ensuring that is continued and sustained is a shame. Mm-hmm. So
that's a privilege sitting down with you and just learning more about SAIS and what you guys do for our community. And yeah, and just even for everybody else to know how to give back. And like you said, just the little things, a bunch of little things really compound to big things. And I think that hopefully our listeners, you know, drop off some food or a bear or quilt some blankets and just, you know, partake in the healing of the people that live here.
That would be wonderful. And I just want to thank the both of you very much for including me in this. I look to you, to the two of you, as heroes. It takes people to get this off the ground and to do what you're doing. And so thank you for including me.
We couldn't be more privileged to have someone like you spend this time with us and share your wisdom about the community. And one of the last things we like to end with is how do you want to be remembered? We're obviously about legacy and giving back, and our goal is, you know, $1 million into this community and tens of thousands of volunteer hours and all the stories that go along with that. So for you personally, how would you like to be remembered?
Besides being remembered as someone who really does give a damn what mm-hmm. happens to people that I live amongst and with, whether I know them or not, I want to be remembered as someone who wasn't afraid to roll up their sleeves, to do what needs to be done, to be there for and with people when they're going through difficult times, whether that's friends, family, acquaintances, colleagues. I just want to be remembered as someone who lived their life to the fullest, putting others before themselves. And am I perfect in that every day? No, I'm not. But that's how I want to live my life, and that's what I strive to do. And hopefully people will look back at me when I'm gone, and I hope that's not for a very, very long time, and said, you know, she did give her heart and soul to something that she believed in. And I do. Mm-hmm. Sometimes to the peril of my own health and my own time with my family, but I'm getting better at structuring a few stronger boundaries, not really where I should be according to my board of directors yet, but I'm working on it.
Well, it's been super inspiring to, you know, come into this space and see what you guys do. We know it's not easy work, but it's very important. So thank you for that.
You're most welcome. It isn't easy work, but it's essential. Mm-hmm. So we will continue to do what we do until we don't need to talk about this anymore. Mm-hmm. I expect that won't be in my lifetime, but maybe in the lifetime of the next generation or two.
That'd be great.
We'll be talking about something else.
That'd be amazing. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
If you were inspired by our show, please take a moment to subscribe and leave a review wherever you listen and share with friends. You can always find show notes at loveyegshow.ca. Keep listening.